This is the MedicCast, June 14th, 2010.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. If you haven't already done so, you want to make sure you head over and check out all of the resources available for you over at the MedicCast blog. MedicCast.com/blog is your resource to find all of the information we talk about in each show, as well as all of the other articles and additional links and things put up throughout the course of each week, as including the video segment for this podcast and the short subject MedicCast TV weekly commentary. So you can find all of that over at the MedicCast blog, medicast.com/blog. I want to welcome all the brand new listeners. A lot of people are starting into a summer course schedule, and we usually see at the beginning of each semester and class schedule that we pick up a lot of new listeners. So I want to welcome you. I am hopeful that you will find the resources that you're looking for here at the MedicCast. And if you can't find what you're looking for, make sure you get in touch with me and let me know that you need to find something in particular. You can always get in touch with me by email, podmedic@mac.com. You can also reach me over at the MedicCast blog. Just leave a comment on any of the articles over there. It'll send me an email and I'll get back to you, maybe by email, or more likely I'll just leave a comment back on the blog in response to you. This is a great way to go ahead and foster conversations over at the MedicCast blog. So definitely leave comments over there when you find an article about which you'd like to have something to say. Sometimes I stir some things up over there and I don't mind. Go ahead and leave your response back. It's part of what makes this show and this community such a great place to share information about the emergency medical services and its environs. You can also always leave a voicemail message, and that voicemail line is 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Check in on the voicemail line, leave a message, and I'll play your voicemail here on the show. Make sure you put your email address right at the very end, leave a little space there, and I will clip it off. No one else will hear it, but that way if I need additional clarification or wanted to check in with you about something, I can shoot you an email to get back in touch with you. In any case, it's great to hear from all of you at any time when you check in here on the MedicCast, and that's one of the things I really enjoy so much about you, the MedicCast audience. Let's jump on in and take a look at a few pieces of listener mail. I got a couple of people checking in on a variety of different things. One of them was a creative outreach approach. The link I got from Chris Callahan, or Chris is checking in, listener Chris, and he was going ahead and sending me a link to a New York medic who has a rap routine he does and records video of in the back of the ambulance. You know, I'll have to put that link in the show notes, but it's great to hear from the listeners. And Chris, thanks a lot for checking in on this particular topic. I'm really looking forward to finding out more about this particular rapping medic artist. And I always love getting links like this from the rest of you. And don't worry, if you check out the show notes for this episode, I will share Chris's link with the rest of you in the show notes. Chris, thanks a lot. I also got an email in from listener Sue. She was recently having a little trouble downloading some of the MedicCast files, and she was wondering about if there was something I could do to help her out. Really wasn't sure exactly what she was talking about, but I know recently we changed the way we linked to files in the show notes and went to a different web player on the site. You may have noticed that. One of the things I like about it is that it automatically puts the player in and also includes a download link. you can right-click on that download link and then select download linked file. You can also control-click on a Mac to get the same effect. And go ahead and download the MP3 files that way. Of course, the easiest way to get the Medicast for all of you is to subscribe to the podcast. You can use iTunes, which is great and free for Mac and Windows, and it doesn't cost you anything to subscribe to any of the podcasts. Or go over and use the Zune Marketplace over on the Windows side of things. And it's a great way for you to get the episodes delivered. You just load up your iTunes or your Zune Marketplace account, and it just automatically reaches out and checks to see if there's any new podcast updates, and it downloads those things automatically. So that's really, I think, the best way to get everything, because if you open that up on a regular basis and are checking in, all of the podcasts that you might find there, including things like Chris Montero's EMS Garage, Greg Fries and the EMS Educast, and Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal, all of those shows are available and easy to get by just having them set up for instant and immediate subscribable download in something like iTunes. And, you know, it's free and it doesn't cost anything. And it's so easy to set up that once you get them there, you can drag them into a folder. You can put them on your MP3 player, whether it's an iPod or some other version. You just drag those files off there into the playlist you want to use, and you're good to go. So, Sue, I hope that answers your question. If any of you have any questions about how to get access to any of the files, or you need to find something and you've tried searching over at the site, you know, there is a search bar at the top of the page, but if you can't find that, you can go ahead and shoot me an email. We'll try to find what you're looking for, at least send you a brief message back to help point you in the right direction. And I don't mind doing that. That's one of the things we like to do here, and I try to provide those services for you here on the Medicast. Sue, thanks for your email, and I look forward to hearing from you again soon. I also heard in from, let's see, listener Justin. Justin sent me a link about in-flight emergencies. Wanted to know, he thought I covered this recently. And actually, I had covered it. I think it's been a couple of years ago that I covered it. But I did talk about in-flight emergencies, what you should think about, some of the things that are usually carried on most air transport here in the United States. So what kind of supplies would you expect to find? And it varies from airline to airline, but there are some basic things that are usually found in that kit to deal with primarily minor trauma and cardiac emergencies. And so there's a link that Justin sent me for an article over on gems.com, and I will include that link in the show notes as well. And Justin, thanks a lot. I'll also include the link back to that episode of the Medicast. You can check that out and listen to what I had to say there. But it's just one of those things that you may be the only responder on an airplane, and when you have someone come on and ask for a medical professional, a doctor or a nurse, you know, volunteer your services. One of the reasons you should always carry your license for your state or whatever the case may be, your certification for National Registry, those things should be with you in your wallet, because it's a way that you can identify who you are and that you are indeed a medical professional as you say you are. And it's something that's important to make sure you maintain. So that's something that you should have with you if you travel a lot, and that you make sure that you have those things available so that you can go ahead and be ready in case there is an in-flight emergency. You know, when you're up at 30,000 feet and everybody's in an enclosed space, you know, even in the best of circumstances, it's going to take 10 or 15 minutes to get back on the ground. So stabilizing a patient in flight with IV fluids, with nitroglycerin, with whatever might be needed to manage that patient while in the air is going to be very important. And, you know, even if there's a nurse or even a physician on board, it may be that you have the most current, up-to-date, and least rusty skills when treating patients in this situation. And Justin, thanks a lot. I will include that link in the show notes. So that's checking all the listener mail. Of course, don't forget, you can always send me that email. Send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com or call in on the voicemail line, whatever the case may be. I love to hear from you, and I look forward to hearing from each of you very soon. Time now to jump on into this week's news items, and I'll start off with a look at a news item I picked up on prescription drug abuse, and something that I picked up from a press release that came out recently This particular press release is from a university services medication report. And this particular report, along with several of the recent reports, we've talked about this in the recent past, talk about the increased prevalence of prescription drug abuse, and specifically patients that are taking or on chronic opioid therapy. They have pain that is only, it is manageable, but they need to manage that with pain medication on a regular basis. Are these patients abusing prescription drugs, or are these patients validly taking medications for their pain? You know, it's a fine line, but I think it's important for us to remember that we should not automatically assume that everyone is drug seeking, that everyone is calling 911 saying they're in pain so that they can get a medication boost. You know, that may well be the case in some situations, but it doesn't mean that we should ignore their pain. If someone says they're having pain and we have the ability to manage that pain with some medication we carry on our units or some therapy we carry on our units, and I include that for BLS providers out there that might be have a patient in the back and can manage pain with an ice pack or with stabilizing an injured limb or with driving more carefully to the hospital and avoiding the bumpier roads. I mean, yeah, it takes you an extra 10 or 15 minutes to get there, but the patient's more comfortable and in less pain when you get there. These are all things you can keep in mind. You don't have to run every fracture patient to the hospital, lights and siren, barreling through intersections and hitting every single bump along the way. You know, an extra 10 minutes isn't going to kill that patient and will help them arrive there in better shape in the long run. So there's a lot of things we can do to manage pain, but I think it's most important that we remember that we should be managing patients' pain. You know, if you haven't checked out the Rogue Medic blog recently, you should do so. Rogue Medic talks in his blog and is covering recently a lot about updating the way that EMS providers deal with pain management and with which our protocols deal with pain management. Because quite honestly, I think a lot of our protocols leave the patients in more pain than they need to be in. We get them to the hospital. One of the first things the physicians and nurses do is give them more pain management. Why can't we give them similar pain management in the field? We carry Narcan if we're using opioid pain management. We have Narcan. If the patient does become apneic and the Narcan's not working, we can manage and ventilate them. I mean, we possess the abilities to manage the side effects of a possible opioid overdose, but so why are we kind of left out there and told we have to just sit there and listen to the patient scream all the way to the hospital? So I think this is important to think about prescription drug abuse, but it's also important for us to manage patients' pain and not make assumptions just because of how they look or where they come from. Pain, if they report pain, we should manage that pain. Let a physician, let the hospital manage and decide whether they can go to an additional treatment opportunity, whether they, if they are indeed addicted to pain medications, that we can provide them additional resources that way. But if they say they're in pain, we should be managing their pain and not assume they're lying just because we don't like the way they look. We don't like the way they present, when they, where they come from, or what time of day or night they may have called us. Let's jump on into the next story. And this is talking about secondhand child's car seats. This is a great article, I think, from Lincoln, Illinois, and it's from the LincolnCourier.com. You know, one of the things that I like about these types of articles is it's a great way, again, for us to reach out into the community. Write a quick article like this and send it off to your local newspapers. Talk to your local radio station and ask them if you could maybe get on a phone interview with them or come into the station and record a brief segment on something like not using secondhand car seats, not buying car seats at yard sales. These are problems, but people don't often think about it. It looks like it's in good shape. Even after a motor vehicle accident that was relatively minor, these seats should be scrapped and people should spend another $40 or $50 on another car seat. You know, I know that this is expensive for some people and there should be resources to help them with that along the way, but we should not have our children restrained in vehicles in an unsafe manner. And it's important for us to make sure that the community around us understands that they should not be reusing car seats. And so as we are now in the summer months here in the United States, and we're going to see a lot of yard sales out there, we should maybe do something to educate our community to talk about the fact that you should not buy car seats secondhand at a yard sale, that they are not necessarily safe. There's no way to determine if they're safe. The only car seats that we know are safe or can safely assume are safe are brand new car seats we've purchased ourselves, and or that we know are brand new and have never been used or never been in an accident. And that's just something that we should keep in mind. I love this article. You should check out the link in the show notes on this article and think about how you could make something like this a feature in your local newspaper or your local TV or radio station. This is something, you know, they're always looking for content. They're always looking for articles, ideas for articles, video and audio segments. You don't just assume that they have everything covered. They're constantly, every day, looking for something to cover. Unless there's some hot news story, they're stuck trying to figure out if they should cover increased number of roadkill seen on the roads in your community. You know, it's just something they've got to do to fill space. Give them something better with which to fill that space, and they'll take it. They'll jump on it, and they may ask you to do something like that on a regular basis. I know, it might be a hassle, but there's so many things we can educate our community about. Let's talk right now and look on into the next and final news story. And it's looking at heat alerts, you know, as we are now in the middle of a summertime here, as I said earlier. Heat alerts are a big issue in many parts of the country. And so, again, it's a great way to reach out to your communities and talk to them about safely dealing with hot situation, hot weather, and understanding how to make sure that they remain hydrated, drinking enough fluids, recognizing the signs and symptoms of heat exhaustion or impending heat stroke in themselves or somebody else, and understand how to self-treat themselves. You know, self-treat themselves, go figure. But certainly, we need to help them understand this. You know, if we can alleviate the number of patients by helping them recognize symptoms early and treating themselves, guess what? They won't call 911. It's another way to remove additional stresses on the system, either the EMS system or the emergency department in your local hospital. And so when you have heat alerts coming up, again, it's a great opportunity for you to put out that alert. Say, you know, extreme hot weather's coming. Do you know how to recognize heat exhaustion? Do you know how to recognize when you're dehydrated? How much fluid does an adult need to drink if they're working out of doors in extreme weather? Well, you know what? That's just something that, you know, all they need to do, oh, I need to plan to have a gallon of water with me when I go out to work in the yard, and I need to stop every hour for 5 or 10 minutes, cool off, drink something in the shade. These little tips, you can tell them, look, you'll get more done because you'll be hydrated, you'll feel better, you'll have more energy to continue working. These are all things you can do to help them understand how to safely work in the heat. And I look forward to seeing a lot of articles. You know, if you get something like this posted in your local paper, either this article or the article about car seats for individual and children, send those in to me. Send those links in to me over here by email, podmedic@mac.com, or you can go ahead and leave a comment right on the article for this episode's show notes. And again, you'll find the link for the show notes right there at the top of the page at medicacast.com/blog. Time for this week's tip of the week, and we're going to jump into some things in this week's tip of the week and talk a little bit about some national registry testing issues. A lot of you, I put something up on the Facebook fan page over at facebook.com/medicast a couple weeks ago, asking what you guys wanted to see more of, what could some of the upcoming tips be, and several people made comments that they'd like to see something about airway and something about testing for registry. So I thought I would include this segment talking about the airway skills test for national registry, both the BLS and the ALS skills portions for ventilatory management and also airway and oxygenation. So we're going to cover the BLS segment first, which you ALS providers should stick around and watch regardless, and then we'll go over and jump on in and look at the segment for the ALS providers as well. And the BLS providers should hang out and watch that one, because really this set of skills is something you should all be familiar with, if only because you may be assisting an ALS provider in the back of the unit, and it would be nice to know to be prepared to do what they expect to do next and be prepared to lend them a hand. So we should all be learning a little bit of what each other's skills are. And of course, ALS providers should be up to date on their BLS skills anyway. Let me go ahead and jump in here and start recording, and then we'll get back in and jump in. So what are we talking about here when we talk about BLS airway management? Well, we're talking about the BLS airway station and bag valve mask station, and then we're going to also later on talk a little bit about oxygenation and some of that. There's often these two stations are combined, so it's something that we'll look at here in this segment. What are we going to start covering here in BLS airway management? Well, we're going to talk about how to prepare adequately for your skill station. What do you need to do to practice before you actually test? So we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about what to do when you get to your skill station and begin to test. We'll cover that briefly. Also, steps and skills for your checklist. How do you manage that? How do you go through the whole process? So we'll review the process of the skill steps station from start to finish. It doesn't take that long. So once you've learned these things, you can practice them pretty quickly. And we'll also talk about, of course, the critical fail points and what to do if you fail, because that's something we should all keep in mind. So let's start about how to prepare for any of our skills tests, whether it's the airway test or maybe some other skill station that you are getting ready for national registry or your state certification. What are some of the things you can do? Well, first off, practice. Okay, there's no substitute or anything you can do that is going to be a substitute for actually getting your hands on the equipment as often as possible and practicing. Now, that might be practicing in class time, finding time when your instructor will make the materials available for you to practice outside of class, practicing maybe at your local station. If you have access to training materials there, you can practice getting equipment out of the bag between calls and looking at it. If you're a BLS provider and driver for a paramedic, you know, looking at the ALS equipment and using it if you're testing for ALS skills. But in BLS skills, just as much hands-on time and practice time as you can. You should use the skill sheets, the checklists that your testing preceptors are going to use. These are available online. Most places use some variation of the National Registry skill sheets, and you can find these online in the resources link right off the front page at nremt.org. I will provide a link in the show notes that'll take you directly to that page that has all the skill stations in PDF format right there ready for you to download. You can check those out, and you should practice to do your skills in the order shown on that sheet. Two reasons. First off, that's the preferred method with which to use the given skill. They want you to do things in a certain order. The other reason is you make it easy on the examiner, okay? The guy who's testing you, the preceptor, is going down that list just like you are. If you do every single thing in order in that checklist, it makes it very easy to test for you, and it makes it very easy to just check things off. And you know what? If you make a minor mistake that isn't an earth-shattering problem, they may give you the benefit of the doubt because you're so sure of yourself and doing everything exactly as the skill sheet is presenting it to them. So that's the other reason why to do it that way. Also, make sure you are visualizing what you need to do when you can't get an opportunity to practice. You know, just like top athletes that visualize themselves going through the motions of whatever their skill is, whether it's a high jump or a football player, envisioning themselves catching passes in different ways or envisioning themselves throwing a block so that they can get around somebody. You know, all of those things are important, and visualization has been proven in the sports sector to cement psychomotor memory, that muscle memory you get when you practice something over and over again. Remember the first part, practice. But if you practice and start building muscle memory, so your muscles actually know, all right, this is how I hold the bag valve mask. They just automatically go into position, right? Take that muscle memory and then cement it in place by thinking about it. All right, get your skill sheet out, read it. All right, See yourself doing the skills. All right, now I'm going to do this. Now I'm going to do this. I need to hook up oxygen now. I'm going to go ahead and turn the oxygen on. Watch yourself. See your hands turning the oxygen bottle on. All of the things you need to do to pass that skill station. Visualization works for anybody that has some kind of skill, psychomotor skill that they need to perform. And so use the visualization. Use those kinds of tools. Record your own or find somebody else's, like mine, audio files. You can listen to this segment over and over and over again. Find a way for you to, again, this helps you visualize. This helps you think about what you're going to do. It helps cement that memory and helps you study. And so all of these things can do, but you don't have to listen to mine. You can get a little recorder or use your phone. Most phones record audio now. You can record a little segment for yourself. And record the visualization of what you're going to do. And then you can listen to it while you're driving. You can listen to it while you're standing in line or doing chores. Just like you listen to podcasts, you can use that tool to help you when you come to test. So what do we do before you begin? You're actually at the testing station. You've gotten there. You're ready to go. You walk in. Do you start right away? Do you jump in and go, okay, I'm ready to go? No, absolutely not. You want to do a couple of things. Check your equipment. National Registry, part of the skill station, at every skill station where you have any kind of hands-on access to equipment, you are allowed to investigate and check that equipment, make sure it's in good working order. And you can't hook things up that you're supposed to hook up during the test, but you can make sure that it hooks up appropriately and then unhook it again. You can lay out things and make sure that everything is there that you're going to need for that skill station. You have a few minutes, not a whole lot of time, but one of the things this does is give you an opportunity to get in there and settle your nerves. Nothing in here is a surprise. It's stuff you've worked on before. Remember the last slide, practice, practice, practice. Make sure everything is in working order and make sure that you know for the airway station, the oropharyngeal airway or nasopharyngeal airway sizes that are used on their mannequins. Almost every mannequin, airway mannequin, is identical in size and shape. Most all of them are adult males. So generally, they all take the same size oropharyngeal and nasopharyngeal airway. If you're testing in your own school setting, they're probably using the same equipment that you use to test on and practice throughout the course of your training. So you know what size. It might be a certain number or size. You know what? Make sure you know which one that is. Make sure that one's there. And you don't necessarily set it right next to the mannequin, but you make sure it's prominent and on top of the pile so that all you have to do is reach over and grab it. You don't have to go digging for it. So these are little tricks that you can use when you're getting set up. After checking, you're going to put things back and, again, disconnect things that you're supposed to connect. But when you do that and put things back, practice putting them in the order in which you're likely to use them according to the skills sheet. You see how easy this is? If everything's laid out in order, you just reach over and grab first one, then two, and you're not being obvious about it, but you've got everything kind of situated in little groups and piles. Maybe all your suction stuff's together and all your airway stuff, oropharyngeal, nasopharyngeal airway stuff is together. Your bag mask is together. Your oxygen tubing. All of that stuff in one spot and in the correct order will save you when time comes for you to go ahead and move on and start your skill station. Then, lastly, and this is really important, take a deep breath. You're ready to go. You've practiced, you've visualized, you've listened, you've practiced and studied, you've gotten your equipment checked out, you're ready to go. You know this stuff. Take a deep breath, blow out slowly, and say, I'm ready to begin. That just extra little bit of time to breathe calms your nerves and lets you move in with an appropriate level of focus to go ahead and get the job done. We're going to start off here with the BLS-02 and airway section, and that's the first skills test. This is often combined with the ventilatory bag valve management skill station. They usually dump them into two, into the same station, get it all done in one shot because they really go together. But I found that sometimes that's not done in every situation, so you may have them as separate skill stations. You're going to always talk about scene safety BSI. Talk about assuming body substance isolation. What's the trick to do this? Put on gloves the beginning of the day when you start the test and don't take them off at all until the end of the day. All right, your hands are going to be sweaty and nasty. I understand that. But let's say you forget to say scene safety BSI. If you have gloves on when you walk into the room and you leave them on, they may give you, again, the benefit of the doubt, saying, well, you're wearing gloves, you must have been thinking about BSI. Little trick, but it might save you. You want to make sure you select and correctly measure and insert an oropharyngeal airway on the mannequin as they have the patient laid out there for you. You're going to remove that oropharyngeal airway when the preceptor says to you, this person has a gag reflex, they've started to become conscious. You remove the oropharyngeal airway. Again, it's not indicated when there's a gag reflex present. You're going to be told that the patient is gurgling, that you hear sounds that mean you need to suction the patient. Suctioning has been ordered. So you're going to quickly prep your suctioning device. You're going to check the airway, and then you're going to, if necessary, measure, if you're using a flexible suctioning catheter, or if you're using something like a stiff Yankauer tip, you're going to make sure that you're suctioning in the visible portion of the oropharynx. You insert the device without suction engaged, then engage suction and withdraw quickly, and don't suction for very long. One of the tricks that you can try with this, although I could never remember to do it, but some people swear by it, is you can go ahead and hold your breath when you go to suction a patient. And you'll notice, if you start to feel like you need to take a breath, the patient probably does too. Get them suctioned, and then if you've got oxygen or bag valve mask, you want to get that back in place. You want to suction from the back of the naso or oral oropharynx, again in the oropharynx, only in the visible portion of the oropharynx. In the nasopharynx, you have measured the device appropriately and are only suctioning to a certain depth. So what's next? Well, you're going to be told now that you have orders to insert a nasopharyngeal airway. Go ahead and measure that nasopharyngeal airway and insert it correctly. Now, again, the nasopharyngeal airway is measured from the side of the nose to the tip of the ear, just like the oropharyngeal airway is measured from the corner of the mouth to the tip of the ear. But in either case, you want to go ahead and measure that device and then prepare to place it appropriately. Next up, you want to verbalize that you're lubricating the nasopharyngeal airway. Most places don't let you lubricate prior to putting it in a mannequin. It usually slides in pretty easily. You then insert it in the mannequin, bevel towards the septum, and advance it until it is firmly in place. And you have now got the nasopharyngeal airway in place. What about critical fail points? You're now finished this first station. What are some of the things that you could have done that would have caused you to completely fail this station? Well, let's talk about that. If you didn't take or verbalize body substance isolation precautions, you're out. Okay, that's one of the reasons I end my shows with scene safety BSI. You just have to do that. You didn't obtain a patent airway with an oropharyngeal airway because you didn't insert it properly. You didn't obtain a patent airway with a nasopharyngeal airway because you didn't insert it properly, it got hung up, you weren't able to advance it all the way. If you didn't demonstrate an acceptable suctioning technique, again, this is one of those reasons you have to practice and use the mannequins and understand how to measure appropriately for your patients. And these are things that I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail about. You should know these things, and they could be different for different areas and different pieces of equipment. So I'm going to let you measure using the equipment with which you're familiar. If you inserted the adjunct in a dangerous manner, a lot of places are using tongue depressors now. They're not putting the oropharyngeal airways in upside down and then rotating them. They're actually putting them in right side up using a tongue depressor to hold the tongue down and then advancing up and over the tongue. So if you're going to do that, use the skill as you're taught by your instructor. Follow those instructions and insert it in a safe manner. But those are the skills' critical fail points. Let's move in and talk about the BLS bag mask for an apneic patient. This is pretty straightforward, but again, a skill station that I've often seen combined with the previous skill station, but it is technically in the National Registry a separate station. Again, scene safety BSI, verbalize and open the airway with a head tilt chin lift, and then go ahead and verbalize, measure, and insert an appropriate airway adjunct. And you can use at your choice here, an oropharyngeal or nasopharyngeal airway. Just measure the one correctly and then go ahead and insert it. Now, even if you've selected the one you know fits the mannequin early and you know which one it is, always measure. Even though you know this is the one that fits, you have to show that you know how to measure appropriately because they aren't one size fits all and you may have other patients of different sizes. So you need to know how to measure which one in the box is going to fit appropriately. You want to select the correct size bag mask for the patient. Again, you might have pediatric and neonatal bag masks there, but you will have already selected the adult bag mask. Make sure it works properly. You'll go ahead and get that bag mask, and you'll begin to ventilate the patient at the correct rate and depth. And generally, this is 10 to 12 breaths per minute. So it's about every breath every 5 or 6 seconds or so. And this would be the normal breathing rate for a bag mask. You now want to connect oxygen and reservoir to the bag valve mask, and you want to set that at 15 liters per minute or more in the oxygen tank. And you actually usually verbalize that. They don't usually have an O2 tank right there. So you'll just go ahead and say, I'm now hooking up the oxygen at 15 liters per minute. Now, just so you know, it is okay to quickly plug the bag valve mask into oxygen before you even start bagging the patient. It is acceptable to combine and do that step in 2 steps, and then you will not have started bagging them on room air and then connecting up to oxygen. But if you do it in order on the skill sheet, and this is one of those places where I say it's okay to connect the oxygen and do it all in one shot. It happens so close together that you're going to go ahead and the preceptor is going to check them all off in one shot anyway. But it's something to keep in mind. You're going to say that the preceptor is going to now tell you that an assistant has arrived, and you're going to go ahead and now demonstrate the two-person bag mask technique. So you're going to verbalize and reopen and readjust the airway. Okay, you've already got the oropharyngeal or nasopharyngeal airway in place, and you're going to go ahead and use your hands to create a mask seal while you talk to the other individual, your assistant, and instruct them on what the correct rate for ventilations is. While they bag, you hold a seal on the mask. And I really recommend using two-person bag mask technique whenever you can, so this is a good thing for you to learn, and it is part of the National Registry Testing Skill Station. What are the critical fail points for the BLS bag valve mask of an apneic patient? Well, these are: did not take or verbalize BSI precautions. You did not immediately ventilate the patient, okay? You've got 30 seconds to get in there and ventilate the patient once they say this patient is not breathing. So you need to get in there and immediately get your bag valve mask, measure and insert your oropharyngeal, nasopharyngeal airway, and immediately begin bagging the patient. So yeah, there's time in there to do O2 and connect it all up before you start bagging, but make sure you're moving briskly. You can interrupt, you don't want to interrupt ventilations once you've started for more than 20 seconds. So if your assistant arrives and you reopen the airway and get a seal, you're going to want to instruct them to begin bagging right away. So you have 20 seconds. Again, one good rule of thumb here is to hold your breath. Usually in about 20 seconds, you'll start to feel like you need to take a breath, and you'll need to go ahead and give the patient a breath too. If you didn't provide high flow oxygen, you forgot to hook the oxygen up at all altogether and didn't hook O2 to the bag valve mask, it's a fail point. We need to get this apneic patient high flow O2 on the bag valve mask. If we didn't provide or direct our assistant to provide adequate ventilations, so if we didn't tell them to watch for chest rise, we didn't ourselves watch for chest rise, we didn't get a good seal with the mask, whatever the case may be, we ventilated them too fast or too slow, all of those things could be critical fail points. So, you know, make sure you're talking through and verbalizing every part of this process in case the preceptor's looking down and didn't see you do something that you didn't verbalize out loud. That's why I always tell people, talk yourself through the process. It's a great way to make sure you don't miss something. And if the preceptor is checking something off on their sheet and they look down, your verbalization of that skill will tell them that you're performing it. You also didn't allow for adequate exhalation. Again, if you're bagging somebody too fast, their lungs don't have time to deflate in between, and that's also inadequate bag valve mask ventilation. All right, bad news. What to do? You failed. Is it awful? Is it everything? Is the life over as you know it? No, this isn't the end of the world, okay? Do you know why you failed? The preceptor in most cases is not allowed to tell you why you failed. They may not even tell you you failed while you're in the station. So if you find out after the fact that you failed, you probably have an inkling of something you missed, or you think back of it and you go, oh, I forgot to hook the oxygen up. Okay, is it the end of the world? No. Couple of things you need to do and get yourself squared away. First off, take another deep breath. This isn't the time to get all pissed off. It isn't the time to start getting all upset and bawling or crying. And believe me, I was a nervous wreck. I think I was almost going to throw up on people several times during my skills test. So I know how it feels. But it's time to suck it up and start talking about what can we do next. So go out and find out if you're allowed to retest the same day. A lot of places will let you do this as long as they have enough preceptors and they're not at the end of their time frame where they can test. So ask the question, hey, is there time for me to retest with another preceptor? So sometimes they'll be able to set this up for you, and that's the best option. It may not always be available, but everything's still fresh in your mind. Presumably, you know what you did wrong, and it was just an oversight, and you can get back in there and fix it, right? So go back and do it, and it's all taken care of. If you fail a second time, or if they can't retest that day, then you want to find out, all right, when are my next opportunities to retest? Where's the next skills test for this thing? It might be a class in a neighboring town. You might have to travel to a neighboring state or jurisdiction for another national registry testing setup. In either case, you want to find out when this is and prepare for it. Get it on your calendar. Don't take too long. Get this set up right away. I know a lot of people who all they had to do was go retest, and they let it go, and they let it go, and they let it go, and it just became too late to retest anymore. They could have retested, they just didn't, which how stupid is that? You also want to make sure you're practicing your skills in between and work on the thing that you might have made a mistake about. Go through all the process we talked about earlier with practicing skill stations, and you can go ahead and be better prepared for the next time when you go through and take your test the next time around. So let's talk about what you do before you begin to get testing on the ALS skill station for ventilatory management. Well, first off, you want to check your equipment. You want to go through and you want to check your bag valve mask, your oxygen supplies. You want to check and make sure your laryngoscopes and blades are all there that you might want to use. If you're a Macintosh Miller blade person, make sure you have the one you like. If you straight and curved blade, you know, some people are like religious about that stuff. So make sure you've got the one you're most comfortable with. Also, make sure the lights are working, make sure the cuff inflates on your ET tube, make sure you've got the stylet and everything you need there to get moving forward. If you need to and you know the mannequin needs it, make sure the preceptor has pre-lubricated the mannequin. Some of them get pretty sticky over the years, and you want to make sure that you're covering for that. You want to make sure everything's in working order. You want to also make sure you've measured the oropharyngeal, nasopharyngeal airways. You probably know which ones fit the mannequins. Have those just kind of laying at the top of the pile so you're ready to go when you have to insert an airway adjunct. After checking, you want to put things back in the order in which you're going to use them. So go through your skills sheet and know, all right, I'm going to need the bag mask and the oropharyngeal airway first. So they're going to be in first in the pile. When you put all these things back, when you're checking all the equipment beforehand, you can do that. Now, you can't leave things put together that have to be put together as part of your test, but you certainly can be prepared to go ahead and have that equipment ready to go in the correct order, at least. So you can put things back as you're testing them and be prepared to do that. After ready to go, just take a breath. You know, take that deep breath. It helps focus you, it helps calm you, and now you're ready to jump in and take the test. So what are we talking about here? Let's go through the adult airway management ventilation station for the National Registry. Scene safety BSI, you're going to operate and say you're prepared for body substance isolation right away. You all know my trick about wearing the gloves from the very start. You want to open that airway manually and go ahead and use a head tilt chin lift. Go ahead and select to correctly measure and insert an oropharyngeal airway and ventilate the patient with a bag valve mask at the rate of about 10 to 12 breaths per minute every 5 to 6 seconds. You're going to go ahead and ventilate for 30 seconds, and then the preceptor will tell you that you need to hook up oxygen, or you will actually hook up oxygen at this point. Now, one of the things that gets me confused here, I always just hook the oxygen up to the bag valve mask before I start ventilating. There's time to do that in the station, and you don't have to go back and do the second step. So you'll see that it's a second step on the skill station. You ventilate with air, room air first, and then ventilate with oxygen. You can, and it's acceptable to go ahead and hook up the bag mask to oxygen. It takes an extra 3 seconds and then go ahead and ventilate with oxygen from the get-go. So that's what I recommend. You'll go ahead and ventilate after you've got oxygen hooked up at the correct rate of 10 to 12 breaths per minute. Now you'll be told that you have orders from medical control to intubate the patient and that you now have a BLS assistant to help you out. This assistant will go ahead and take over bag mask. Usually the preceptor takes over at this point. you'll direct that assistant to pre-oxygenate the patient. Usually, in this case, it's giving them breaths at the rate of about 12 to 20 breaths per minute. So you're going to go ahead and give them breaths every 3 to 4 seconds, let's say. And you go ahead and have them pre-oxygenate your patient. You want to set up now, and you want to check and make sure your ET equipment is working properly. Now, it's your laryngoscope blades, your endotracheal tubes, make sure the cuff inflates and has no leaks, and that it's all ready to go with your patient. Get your stylet in place, and you're good to go. Now, you've already checked the equipment, but again, this is that part of the testing process. This is why I said you can't leave stuff assembled. You have to put the stylet in and measure it again yourself. But you've already checked it. You're already familiar with it beforehand. Go ahead and instruct your assistant to remove the bag valve mask and the airway adjunct, and you are now ready to go ahead and intubate this patient. You're going to go ahead and position the head in a sniffing position, insert your blade, sweeping the tongue to the side, and elevate the mandible in a correct fashion. You're going to go ahead and insert that ET tube, advancing it through the vocal cords and to the proper depth. Now, here's what you do. Talk your way through everything. Oh, I visualize the cords. I'm passing the bag mat. I'm passing the endotracheal tube through the cords. Talk your way through it. Talk about every step. It's one of the ways to make the preceptor know, hey, this guy knows what he's doing. So go ahead and do that while you're walking through this. You want to go ahead and inflate the cuff. Remove the syringe. That's a fail point if you don't remove that syringe after you inflate the cuff. But inflate the cuff, direct your assistant to ventilate immediately via the tube, and then you will auscultate the patient via the bilaterally over the lungs and over the epigastrium, listening for breath sounds and absence of sounds over the epigastrium. That's one way you're going to check your tube. You're also going to check your tube by another method. It might be a capnometric device where it changes color with the presence of CO2. You could use some kind of an esophageal detection device, presence of moisture condensation in the tube. There are a number of ways you can do that. You can say, I visualize progression through the cords. You can talk about hooking up to a capnography device. Whatever the case may be, you want to make sure you verbalize that you're checking via other means. You're going to now be advised there's gurgling sounds in the tube in the presence of fluid coming up the tube. You're going to tell your assistant again to pre-oxygenate the patient. You're going to go ahead and select and measure correctly your flexible suction catheter for the tube. You're going to go ahead and mark that depth, pinching the section of flexible catheter between your thumb and forefinger, and then you're going to have your assistant stop ventilating. You're going to advance the suction catheter down the tube without suction engaged, then engage suction and suction on the way back up. Then when you've done that, you're going to go ahead and get the patient back on the ventilation with your assistant. So you direct them to immediately ventilate the patient again and ventilate them at the proper rate of 10 to 12 breaths per minute. What are the critical fail points? There are a lot of them for this station. We're going to run through them quickly. If you print out the skill sheets that you can find over at National Registry or get them from your instructor, you'll be able to find these listed right at the bottom. You didn't take or visualize BSI precautions, verbalize them. You didn't ventilate within 30 seconds of saying ready and ready to go, and we are observing body substance isolation precautions. If you stopped ventilation at any time for more than 30 seconds, if you failed at any time to provide high flow O2 to the patient, and again, 15 liters per minute. If you failed to ventilate at the proper rate or volume appropriate to this patient, either during normal ventilation or when you're pre-oxygenating. If you fail to pre-oxygenate that patient prior to either putting the endotracheal tube in place or suctioning. If you fail to successfully intubate in 3 attempts, fail to disconnect the cuff syringe immediately. Use the teeth as a leverage or fulcrum to get the mandible lifted up. It's a fail point. Most mannequins click when you push against the teeth too hard, and that's an instant audible signal that you failed. But you should be aware of that. Failure to assure that the tube's correctly in place by using auscultation and another method and verbalizing what those other methods are. Stylet. When you inserted the tube, extended beyond the distal end of the tube, it's a fail point. That stylet needs to be up inside the tube, inside the soft plastic, so that it's not causing damage to the airway. And you inserted the adjunct, the oropharyngeal, nasopharyngeal airway, in a manner that was not safe for your patient. Or you suctioned for more than 10 seconds, or didn't suction at all when you were told that there were gurgling sounds coming from the airway. These are the steps that you can look at, and additional resources you'll find in the show notes for this episode, and you can find all of that over at the show notes for this particular segment. You'll find those links at medicast.com/blog. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week. Remind you that you'll find links to all of the news items and segment resources for each of the tips in this particular episode over at medicast.com/blog in the show notes for this episode. And you can find those listed at the top of the page under the show notes link. You go ahead and find the episode you're looking for, click on that link in the show notes section, and you can go ahead and find all of the resources from that episode there. You can also make sure you get back in touch with me. Did you like this episode? Did I make a mistake? Did I completely screw up? Or do you want to send me an interesting link regarding something in this episode? Whatever the case may be, get back in touch with me. You can leave a comment over on the show notes for this episode using the comment link at the top or bottom of each page. You can also go ahead and shoot me an email. Podmedic@mac.com is the way you can get a hold of me. And, of course, you can also call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342. Don't forget, you can also find me over at Twitter and Facebook under the handle Podmedic, twitter.com/podmedic and facebook.com/podmedic. And of course, don't forget to become a fan of the MedicCast over on the Facebook fan page, and you'll find that over at facebook.com/MedicCast. I also want to remind you, hey folks, I've got a brand new video show that's out now. You can find it in iTunes if you search for MedicCast TV. It's a weekly short commentary. So these are short little video segments. They'll play on your computer, on the website. Also, you can play them and download them onto your MP3 video player. So something like an iPod Touch or an iPhone or something like that. All of that will play there. And you can check out those over at MedicCast.tv. So you'll find the information on all over there, and you can again find it in iTunes as well. So I urge you to follow up on that and check out that brand new show available for you over in iTunes. Well, that's it for me. I'm going to go ahead and close out the show with some great PodSafe music, again from the PodSafe Music Network, music.podshow.com. This is an artist by the name of Laura Clapp and her song, Not Responsible. We've played it before here on the show, one of my favorites, and I hope you like it as well. If you like the song, you'll find a link to Laura's website in the show notes. You'll also find a link to purchase her song over in iTunes. So, you know, spend a $1, $1.25 or whatever it is over at iTunes to pick up one of her songs. Let Laura know that you appreciate her providing her music here to artists like myself and our podcast, and I really like having her great music to listen to and to play for you, the listeners here at the MedicCast. So I hope you will go ahead and follow through on that. In the meantime, this is it for me. This show comes out every Sunday night, regularly, ready to go for you first thing Monday morning. So go ahead and be ready for the next episode of the MedicCast, and you'll find that at the MedicCast site, medicast.com/blog. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'll be back again soon. In the meantime, remember, scene safety, BSI.
Wrap your guilt around me when you don't get your way. And you bleed all this blame. Clean your cut, wrap it up, take care of your own pain. 'Cause it's you, not me, who's gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, feeling used, and I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not responsible. Why can't you let it go? Oh, yeah, 'cause all that you're crying about happened 2 years ago or more. You hit rock bottom, now you're pacing its floor. But what I'm talking about is climbing out. Well, no one's help but Joel Rohn, cause it's you, not me, who's gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, not you, that ends up feeling used. And I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not responsible. Grow some backbone, stand up for yourself. Cause I ain't taking no more, and neither is no one else. But I'm not responsible.